Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a saying that I'm going to quote from the news release. A community is only as strong as its citizens. Fragile families can only build a fragile community, but a strong and vibrant community depends on strong families. And that is why the Indiana Parenting Institute is putting things together for its very first State of the Family Luncheons coming up on Friday. With us to talk about it, we have the COO of the Indiana Family Institute, Janae Beleza, with us. Janae, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure to be on the show with you.
Give us an idea of the work and all that's planning this event, the very first event that's coming Friday at Avalon Manor.
Well, we used to do a thing called the Women's Mental Health Luncheon. And so we're a family organization, and we're really about strengthening families and ensuring that the family dynamic, you know, however it evolves, has the ability to ensure that it is setting the appropriate foundation for our society, because families are the foundation of our society. And so I said, why don't we call it State of the Family? My mom and I were talking. My mom is the CEO. And I said, why don't we call it State of the Family instead of Women's Mental Health? And she's like, oh. She goes, that's a cool idea. And it's not my wonderful, great idea. She actually spoke at a State of the Family event downstate. And so I said, why don't we have our own local version of that and hold it ourselves? So that's what this is. And it's really about the opportunity annually to assess, to learn about and assess what the state of family is, not just nationwide, but really in Northwest Indiana. So we have folks from the state to get that broader perspective, and from Northwest Indiana proper, the Lake County Health Officer is going to be here as well, talking about the areas of education, health and welfare for families.
I know events like this typically have not only speakers, topics that you bring up, but just an opportunity for, I guess, a question and answer session, conversation. How is it all fitting in together for this event coming up Friday?
Well, basically the rundown is we have a keynote speaker. Her name is Dr. Mahalia Hines. I don't know if the folks listening out there know of the rapper, actor Common, but it's his mom. And she's going to really come and discuss. Well, I'm going to put it this way. You know, we raise our kids, and sometimes we don't really know what the outcome is going to be. We just hope that it's something good, because, you know, we don't really know what they're going to want to do. You know, it's not really up to us what they choose to do with their adult lives, but it's as a career. But interesting to have someone who was able to raise a son who is as impactful as her son is in an urban environment, because they are from Chicago, and how she was able to, whether he got in trouble, as all kids do, or not, was able to direct that attention to do something positive. It's called parenting success. So what are you parenting? I'm parenting success. I'm parenting my child, but I'm parenting success. And so she's going to come and talk to families about how she parented success and as a result got the outcome from her son as she did, who is not only a rapper, but he's an artist, he's an activist, a philanthropist. I mean, he gives back to his community. I mean, there's always that fork in the road that we hit as we're growing up, you know, and how to make sure that your kid picks that pathway that is to his or her greatest benefit is a challenge. But, you know, she has some insights into how she was able to do that with her son. So,
how difficult was it to get Dr. Hines to come to this event?
You have to book her about a year in advance.
Well, I guess you have to plan something like this about that far ahead anyway, don't you? So it just makes sense that you would want the best speaker you can and the most insightful thoughts, and somebody as important and has something important to say as Dr. Hines will have.
Right. I'm looking forward to her story. But also then after that, we have a panel of three folks covering one education, one health, and one welfare. Education is going to be the executive director of the governor's workforce cabinet, which I serve on that. And his name is Patrick McGrew, but we call him PJ. So PJ used to also be the chief of staff for the Indiana State Board of Education. So he's got some real insight into education and the trends and the path that it's gone down. So that'll be interesting to hear from and be able to ask him some questions. We've got Chandana Vavilala, who I'm learning how to say her name. I apologize if I've butchered it horrifically. To those listening out there that know Dr. Vavilala, Fabi Lala, but and she is the Lake County Health Officer as well as an internist with Franciscan Health. And then we have David Reed, who is the Deputy Director of Child Welfare Services for the Indiana Department of Child Services. And David is one of the most passionate people about kids and families I have ever met. So I am so excited he was available for this because and he's worked with DCS for a while. Before that, he was with Villages. And just I've had some wonderful conversations with him, and I'm looking forward to unleashing him on the community so that they can see who they've got downstate really working for families.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, with the events coming up on Friday, obviously you want to get as many reservations made as soon as possible to be sure that you have a place and a meal.
You know what? We actually have 10 tickets left.
Wow. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. So if you are interested in knowing how you can raise a comment, I like to put it that way, because at the end of the day, I just want to say this one thing, that a lot of times people are like, how am I going to raise these kids? But you're not raising a kid, you're raising an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So learn how to raise a common, and also to get some questions and answers on what's going on with family with regards to education, health, and welfare in terms of laws, in terms of trends, in terms of resources. The way that you RSVP or the way that you get on board is that you go to Eventbrite.
Mm-hmm.
You can also call our offices at 219-886-1111, but we'll probably tell you to go to Eventbrite. If you can't, we have been taking checks from folks, so that is an option as well. Yes, I did say checks. It's $50 a ticket, and we again, we're feeding you a wonderful lunch. It starts at – oh, I didn't give the time, did I?
Nope.
It starts doors open at 9:30. It goes from 10 to 1. And Dr. Hines begins speaking right before lunch at about 10:10. Mm-hmm. So about 10 o'clock.
In this case, since you have so few tickets left, mm-hmm. Will the folks at Eventbrite be able to help keep track of things and if they get cancellations and all, so they can fit people in if need
exactly.
be?
And what I would recommend is that if you do try and purchase a ticket and it says sold out, that you call us, because we can put you on a wait list. And as soon as we learn that somebody can't make it, we will definitely reach out to you and get you in. So, but yeah, under Eventbrite, it's called State of the Family Luncheon. Just do a search for that and it'll mm-hmm. pop up.
Well, sounds like for the very first event that you're getting off to a really good start, mm-hmm. certainly with blockbuster speakers all around, for that matter, Dr. Hines and everybody else that's going to be in the panel discussion later. And just the topic this time around, too, is going to be bringing a lot of attention. So it will kind of pave the way for more successful
right.
State of the Family Luncheons next year.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this being a regular thing, and that the community is in, hoping that the community is very interested to know what's going on with families and for families so that they can be better prepared.
Janae Beleza is with the Indiana Parenting Institute, which is putting on its very first State of the Family Luncheon coming up on Friday at Avalon Manor mm-hmm. here in Hobart, Merivale. And thank you for being with us to talk about that. It's nice to know, that, as you certainly are surprised to know, that so many people are so interested that the tickets are almost gone.
I know.
Thanks
see,
for spending.
Fam, talking about family is a good thing.
Thanks for spending time with us to talk about today.
Thank you.
This is National Hispanic Heritage Month, and it's an opportunity not only for the general public to learn something about one segment of our society, but also for educators and the young people that they help teach as well, too, and particularly here in Indiana, and Northwest Indiana in particular, because we have such a sizable Hispanic population here. Tammy Silverman is president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, and they do a lot of counseling for grown-ups, educators, as well as helping young people along, too. And Tammy is with us to talk about National Hispanic Heritage Month. And Tammy, thank you for joining us today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, throw some facts out at us here about the history of Hispanic Heritage Month to start with.
Well, you know, I think I was kind of taken back when I learned how long that it has been around. And I think it's quite impressive that it was actually started in 1968 by President Lyndon Johnson. And at that time, it was a one-week celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was extended to a month-long celebration by President Reagan in 1988. So for a good number of years, this has been a time for us to really honor and celebrate and recognize the contribution and diverse cultures that are related to the histories of Americans who come from or their ancestors came from Spain, Mexico, the Caribbean, Central, South America.
Now, I know that you have your hands there at the IYI on lots of data that come in here. Fill us in on some of the things that we should know about Indiana's Hispanic population.
Absolutely. You know we love our data. So Indiana's child population in general has continued to increase in racial and ethnic diversity over the past 10 years. And it's actually quite, you know, it's much more diverse than the adult population. And we see that trend continuing for the foreseeable future. And the Hispanic population in particular has seen the largest increase over the past 10 years. It's gone up by just about 2.5%.
Mm-hmm. Now, do the curriculum that are set up in school districts, either individually or on a statewide basis, do they include information about, in their American history classes, maybe we should add, about Hispanics and about the Hispanic heritage?
I think a lot of them do, and I think particularly in areas such as yours, Chris, that understands that they have a lot of children and youth of Latino heritage, and so many of them do. At the same time, if you don't, or if you want to expand upon that curriculum, you know, one of the things that we found is there are a lot of great resources that are already out there and available for anyone to use. So you do not have to recreate the wheel that, in fact, the U.S. Department of Education, Smithsonian Education, and the National Education Association all have pre-prepared, that's kind of hard to say, but lessons, student activities, quizzes, videos, all of those kind of things which do celebrate National Hispanic Heritage Month, and they're ready to go.
Wow, that's right. About history, about famous people, that sort of thing, the whole limit?
Absolutely, and you know what's the great thing is all three of them break them down by different grade levels. So there's a bunch of resources that are out there for elementary, kind of K through 4. Then there's the middle school 5 through 8, and then there's also curriculum and resources that are more geared towards high school students 9 through 12. Mm-hmm. So again, you don't have to go out and try to create all that yourself. It's already out there and ready to be used.
Now, how about here in Indiana? Do we have any organizations that help offer this type of material to teachers and to school districts to help them teach young people about it?
I'm so glad you asked because, of course, yes, we do. The Indiana Latino Institute, the Indiana Commission on Hispanic and Latino Affairs are both two of the leaders statewide. La Plaza, Indianapolis, the name Indianapolis is in there, but they help a lot more beyond that. Yeah. And then one that I'm not sure that I knew a lot about before we started doing some of this research is the Girl Scouts are doing some really neat and innovative things to make sure that they're responding to and engaging Indiana's Hispanic children and families.
And we talk here about opportunities for students to learn more in their American history classes or the modules maybe within the other curriculum in a school. How about teachers? What do you folks at the IYI have to offer to help teachers learn more about National Hispanic Heritage Month and to be able to prepare themselves to be able to teach young people about it?
Right. And I think for all kids, but in particular for Latino students, far too many of them have been given the message that maybe they're not ready for college, maybe they're not ready. You know, they've gotten a lot of negative information. And so it's important that we tell students that they can succeed, that every student, and reinforce particularly with new English speakers, that they can overcome those language barriers. We know that that's a reality that many kids do overcome. So we need to make sure that we're planting those early positive messages and repeating them and start talking to kids early about thinking about and preparing for post-secondary, whether that's two-year college, four-year college certificate, you know, and we really want to stay away from being dismissive and assuming based on somebody's ethnicity that they don't want to go to college because we know that that's not true and that every kid has the capacity and we want to make sure that they reach their full potential.
Does this extend over to parents, Latino parents in particular?
You bet. You know, one of the things that we've seen a lot of programs really embrace is that oftentimes Latino families really wrap around their kids. So we need to make sure that when we're doing after-school programming or programming at the school, that we include extended families, right? So grandma and grandpa might want to come, an aunt or an uncle or two or three, and that's a really positive support network. So we want to make sure that we're looking at those parents and extended family members as partners in their child's success.
Now, are there any opportunities that folks can find on the IYI website to learn more about this, and in particular, a little bit more about National Hispanic Heritage Month?
You bet. IYI.org, it's right there at your fingertips, as well as other resources and data. Anything that you would need, start with us, and if it's not there, then you can shoot us an email or give us a call, and we'll see what we can do to track it down for you.
Well, thanks, Tammy, for being with us to talk about this National Hispanic Heritage Month and the information that the IYI has available to help educate all of us about this very special month. Thank you very much.
Always my pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Kevin Comerford continues his conversation now with Ty Warner about NERPC today on Building Northwest Indiana.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford, with the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana. Back in the studio with me today is Ty Warner, the executive director of the Northwest Indiana Regional Planning Commission, otherwise known as NERPC. Ty, last week you gave us a little bit of background on what NERPC does as an organization. We covered the 2050 plan, which you explained is a long-range transportation plan that encompasses basically four specific topics, being economics, environment, mobility, as well as people and leaders. If you didn't get a chance to catch last week's segment, you could find it at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Ty, today I wanted to touch on the future of transportation.
Well, when I hear about the future of transportation, I think a lot about a lot of what I see in the news, you know, the autonomous driving vehicles. I think Uber has recently launched autonomous driving vehicles. Tesla has, Elon Musk has his Boring machine with some kind of Hyperloop. And then you also see high-speed rail, you know, making a play, especially in California. I think they've recently been investing a lot of money into high-speed rail as they see it as the future. Now, has NERPC actually looked at some of these new innovations and taken them into consideration when developing the 2050 plan?
Yeah, NWI 2050, the plan I just talked about, does try to look at, you know, not just the things of how we fund what's on the immediate horizon, but looking out and what's coming way off into the future. And this all has huge implications for, you know, the region, obviously, if any of these things come to bear. High-speed rail, we've been coordinating with efforts to try to create high-speed rail links between Chicago and basically around Detroit, so Pontiac, Michigan. And then another effort to try to link high-speed rail from Chicago to Columbus, Ohio. And part of that that effort from Columbus to Chicago, that led to a situation where Virgin Hyperloop won, and which is a private company. Elon Musk kind of put this idea out there, but there's several different private companies that are actually running with it now or trying to. Virgin Hyperloop won, had a competition globally to try to look at top corridors that they want to look at for further study for this concept. And selected that route from Columbus to Chicago as one of them worldwide, but also extending it to Pittsburgh. So that whole connection. And to give you an idea of how fast this thing goes, this is like a some people describe it as like the pneumatic bank teller, tube thing, but you put people in it, you know, and you eliminate air so there's no air resistance, it's maglev so that there's no friction, and you put those in sealed tubes, and they can get up to 700 miles per hour according to the physics involved in all this. So you're talking about a half-hour trip from Chicago to Columbus. In fact, my counterpart in Columbus for the regional agency out there, we've talked about meeting up for lunch in Fort Wayne because it's only 15 minutes, you know, from each direction. So who knows what will happen, but, you know, folks, the private companies are looking at this. And then there's another effort to look at it with a whole different Hyperloop company from Cleveland to Chicago and look at that corridor, also interestingly enough, connecting onto Pittsburgh on the other end. So that's on the horizon. You mentioned autonomous vehicles, huge impacts with that also in terms of our landscape when you don't have to have parking in the center of cities because the vehicles themselves can park themselves on the outskirts of town. That opens up development opportunities right in downtown areas, creates situations for people with limited mobility to be able to get where they need to go. Whole bunch of implications for Northwest Indiana for that as well.
I guess another thing that is coming in the future, and some would say is already here, is gas mileage. There's standards that the federal government has put in place that kind of wants you to have higher fuel mileage, you know, for every vehicle. Is that affecting the funding for not only NERPC but for the federal government and the highway system and even the state Because I know they take a portion of that gas tax as well.
It absolutely is. And it's the effect of, you know, we haven't had a new source of revenue for these infrastructure improvements and for construction projects for transportation. Gas tax hasn't been raised since, I believe, 1992 or so, that 18 cents I mentioned at the beginning here. That's been the same ever since then. And so it hasn't been raised, and so it doesn't buy as much now. And all that money that what I talked about in a very simplistic way, that money from when you fill up your gas tank and where those tax dollars go, goes to something called the Highway Trust Fund, and that's where that money is drawn from for everything that I just talked about. So we have the situation where, rightly so, we and everybody else on the federal level and the state and everywhere are trying to promote more fuel efficient vehicles, alternative fuels, electric vehicles, all these things. Which is great. I mean, that's exactly what we should be doing, reducing our dependence on foreign oil and all of that, and better for the environment. But it's got the ramification that if your sole source of funding transportation improvements is based on gasoline purchases, you're doing all these things to reduce the consumption of gasoline. Plus, you haven't raised the gas tax in, you know, however long. And so a lot less money is coming into that highway trust fund. So you're absolutely right. There's a lot less money available to do these things. And we're going to run into a situation at the end of this current transportation bill where we have to find new solutions to fund these things. And some things are getting looked at elsewhere. Obviously, the simple sort of knee-jerk, which is probably the wrong term to use, but the simple solution is to raise the gas tax even further. I don't know what the appetite is for that. There are several states that have been working with pilot programs to try to track vehicle miles traveled. So if you're literally paying based on how many miles your vehicle is traveling, and with technology, there's ways to do that. And what's being addressed in these pilot programs is every concern that you can think of privacy and other things. How do we address that, but still do some equitable way of funding? And that's really what it comes down to, is what's an equitable way to fund transportation improvements. You know, the bottom line is that there's the general philosophy, and that's why the gas tax is put in place, is that those that are using the infrastructure should pay for the infrastructure. And at the time, and when the gas tax was first put in place, that was seen as the most direct user fee that anybody could come up with. If you're buying the gas to travel on the roads, the tax on that gas is helping to fix the roads.
That's all the time we have for today. You can join us next week as Ty and I pick up this conversation again during Morning Edition, Regionally Speaking, and All Things Considered.
Support for Building Northwest Indiana comes from the Construction Advancement Foundation, and you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM every Tuesday, and the podcasts are also available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in the Miller section of Gary in the late 1960s through the 70s. And it was typical white, suburbia, middle class upbringing, but it was changing. Everything was in flux back then in the late 60s and early 70s in Gary. What was predominantly a white community, especially in Miller, which is the more affluent section of Gary, you know, to this day probably. So everything was in flux, and I was living in this little, as I call it, a Wonder Years kind of existence, you know, the Kevin Arnold Wonder Years, and everything was just kind of like that. That was my bubble I lived in. And I didn't realize all the bigger forces swirling around me in this big city of Gary and all this tumultuous change. I just didn't think of that at all. So I was quite content and quite happy. And then as I got into middle school, that's when we were taught more about race relations. I went to Kennedy King Junior High for Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. So a lot of these things were taught to us. And they were saying, this is a perfect model city to watch this in action. These race relations and these bigger things are happening in the country and the world and in this little city. So I realized that my little Wonder Bread existence of Miller was not quite what I thought it was. It was bigger and broader than that. And there was one instance that happened in high school that I remember really well. I was in band class. I was like a band geek in school. I played saxophone. And I was competed with other saxophone players for this first, second, and third chairs. And one of the kids' name was Alfred Hammonds. I'm pretty sure that's his name. And we would compete back and forth. He was a black kid. And we'd compete back and forth for first chair of alto saxophone. It was a little bragging rights thing, okay? This is at Wirt High School in Gary now. But one day, it was a heavy snowfall. And school got let out a little bit early so we can get our buses early, have our parents pick us up early. And we had a little extra time on our hands. So what did kids do in a snowstorm? They had a snowball fight. And typically it'd be like the jocks and the heads and the potheads and geeks and freaks and band geeks. You know, you go to your certain cliques and then you just team up and you go at it. But in this day, it teamed up white versus black for the most part. And I saw Alfred and I throwing snowballs at each other with zeal and zest and maybe some animosity, or just because we're supposed to do it. And we both looked at each other, I thought, at that moment and go, oh, this is not the same as it used to be. We're no longer band geeks. We're no longer jocks and heads as much. It's kind of a race thing. So we separate on those lines. You know, I believe these days there's 10% over here and 10% over there. It's the 80% in the middle that is the determining factor. And those 80% are like lemmings or sheep, and they can get swayed so easily. And I think I was part of the 80% that just got swayed so easily. I mean, there's no way at that age, I was 16 or 17, that I would jump on the black side with Alfred Hammond and start throwing at these white jocks and heads. I just didn't have it in me. I didn't even think about it, actually. I think we reconciled it, and we kind of compartmentalized it and just put it to the side. We were still fine. We were still buds in class and competing and playing music together. We, you know, created music together. You know, that's a synergy right off the bat that kind of transcends even race and other issues and problems. We were fine. It wasn't that big of a deal. But I did notice that things changed. Today, I would discuss it in a heartbeat. I would love to meet Alfred Hammonds again and talk. Do you remember that? No. Oh, okay, sorry. You know, I would think he probably would not remember it at all. To me, it's like some landmark, you know, issue that happened in my life involving race relations in this region.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The Greenways Foundation of Indiana is working with the Indiana Parks and Recreation Association to come up with a series of workshops on what are called trail towns. Well, what's a trail town, and why should you be interested here in Northwest Indiana? Well, we have the board president of the Greenways Foundation with us. He just happens to be Mitch Barloga, who is with NERPSI. And Mitch, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Chris.
Tell us first a little bit about the Greenways Foundation, because it's a statewide organization, has board members represent, I think, almost every facet of every corner of the state, don't they?
Exactly. We do have board members situated throughout the state of Indiana, and we are a nonprofit 501c3 corporation that is looking to raise funds to help communities as well as advocates to expand our trail network throughout all of Indiana.
Mm-hmm. We are very familiar with the trails, and you can't hardly go anywhere in many sections of the state, including Northwest Indiana, without encountering a trail, either having to slow down for crossing or maybe going alongside. There are trails that do pick up alongside city streets here in Northwest Indiana, so they're always out there. But in turn, how do they get involved with this, the community at large? You're talking about trail towns.
Right.
What's the concept that the association is looking at, foundation's looking at?
Right? Correct.
Yeah.
Trail towns is a concept that started out with the Great Allegheny Passage, which is in the Pennsylvania-Maryland area. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely long trail, and there were many communities that were located around it. And so the idea was, how do we make these communities more attractive for people on the trail to come and visit and to try to reap some economic benefits of the people using it? So trail towns grew out of that, and now it is kind of emerging through the East and coming this way. We have programs throughout Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and even into Michigan. Now, the Greenways Foundation, what we're trying to work with is a consultant out of Pennsylvania. Her name is Amy Camp, and she has been able to do this throughout the country and get communities and regions excited about the concept of trail towns. And so we're taking a big splash. We have organized 6 workshops throughout the state this year, and it's going to happen from Halloween all the way through the following week on November 8th. And our first workshop will happen here in Portage on Halloween night, mm-hmm. or Halloween morning, that is. So the idea is to share with stakeholders in Northwest Indiana, and stakeholders is a very broad term, and in this case, you're talking about public entities, people who own businesses that may be around trails, and also just advocates in general and even users of the trail, to figure out how to best position communities to be attractive for people, for trail users. And a lot of people who use trails, again, the Great Allegheny Passage is kind of a tourist destination, mm-hmm. where it's nearly, you know, 80 to 100 miles in length. So people are not going to take, you know, a day trip. They're going to be out there for multiple days. So you have to accommodate these trail users with overnight accommodations, restaurants, and other places where they can enjoy and relax. And we just want to make sure that those tools are available to our communities too. We have over 160 miles of trail throughout Northwest Indiana. So conceivably, people can come here in this region and stay a night or two. And not even those who are visiting, just people that live here. If you live in Hammond, you might want to visit Chesterton. You could connect all the way through to Chesterton on trail today. And that's a pretty long ride. You're talking about 20, 30, even a 40-mile ride. And so people might want to stay the night in Chesterton, enjoy some of the restaurants out there. So we have to make sure that businesses can be bike friendly, and there are a lot of strategies for that, for accommodating bicycles and bicycle users. Restaurants are also in the mix of that as well. Discounts can be afforded. And so those are strategies we're looking forward to learning about during these workshops.
Was there anything you mentioned about the Allegheny Trail in particular in Pennsylvania? Was there anything in doing the research, learning about that trail and all of the opportunities that they made available for economic development along the trail, the places to stay for the overnights or places to eat or the like, other tourism that's probably located in very close by, I would imagine, to the trail? Were those ideas that they have put forth that you were able to want to put into this particular this series of trail towns, as you call it?
Yeah, and I'm not going to look at that because I'm not nearly as familiar with the Great Allegheny Passage. What I am familiar with is what's called the High Trestle Trail in central Iowa near Des Moines. And I had an opportunity firsthand to take a look at what's going on out there. And the High Trestle Trail runs maybe 20 or 30 miles, but it's kind of in an isolated area of Iowa, but it gets a tremendous amount of tourist interest because they have this tremendous bridge that goes over basically a gorge with the Des Moines River. But there are nearby towns that have taken advantage of this interest, and they have accommodated people that use the trail. And I actually had the opportunity to visit a hotel, an old hotel that was restored, and it accommodates bicycles. It helps store bicycles. It provides services for people who are on bicycles, you know, with repairs and with other types of accommodations. And so learning from that really opened my eyes to the potential of what we could take advantage of here in the region and really not only make our trails even more attractive to people living here, but also people that might want to visit.
So it's really, although it's a jump in history, it's probably an extension of what was established when the Model T was out there on the very early highways, like the National Road and other highways as well, too, where you had stops along the way and you had places that would repair vehicles if there people were making the trek.
And that's exactly the case. You make an excellent point about a historical reference here. You know, the Lincoln Highway in Dyer used to be the ideal section. It was the first paved segment of highway in the United States. And there was a lot of hotels and restaurants that were built specifically to accommodate the motorists. Now you have that today, but it's not, you know, it's not nearly as friendly as it may once have been. And again, with trails, it is more of a personal issue. People are seeing people face to face here, and there's a lot of interaction. People that, you know, work with each other on the trail themselves, and they are able to pass the information on to potential visitors to this region.
Now, is Amy Camp going to come over to each of the workshops, starting with the one on Halloween morning in Portage, and make all the other treks? Because we're talking basically Portage and South Bend, Fort Wayne, Evansville, Terre Haute, Carmel. She's covering the entire state.
She certainly is. And yes, she understands what's involved here. And there are some interesting travels that she's going to have to take care of. I think she's going from South Bend to Evansville in one day. And
oh my goodness.
Hopefully she's not going to put me off of her Christmas card list for that one. But even so, she is very eager to make this work, because what we want to do at the Greenways Foundation is use this as kind of a starting block for us to create a Trails Town program for Indiana, where we can work with communities on making sure that they are Trail Town certified, where we have certifications for different things like Tree City USA and Bicycle Friendly Community. Well, we want to start a Trail Town program. There's only one in the country that we know of that's on a statewide basis, and that's in Kentucky, that is being run by their tourism office. So we're looking to have that same type of energy afforded here in Indiana.
Now, if that does come about, if you do have the Trail Town series that's set up, who might be, it's probably one of the things you'll have to work out after the consulting and talking to people in every corner of the state as to who's going to be running this thing if you do establish it.
Well, that's the idea. We want to get a groundswell of interest and energy behind it, and so it'll make it a lot easier for that agency to kind of take the reins of it. I mean, the Greenways Foundation could do it, but we are an all-volunteer organization. Mm-hmm. We do not have paid staff. However, tourism does, and they would be a logical outlet because, again, it is an economic development tool for these communities that embrace these.
So it could get turned over and maybe put together with the Indiana tourism efforts, I guess, if it works out that way?
Well, certainly. And you have to remember, too, you know, Chris, the entire state is under this kind of trail revolution where we have Governor Holcomb giving $90 million for new trail development in the state. We've had the recent conclusion of the Bicycle Trails Task Force that has called for 500 miles of interconnected trails throughout all of the state of Indiana. And that is moving forward quite well. And so this all is coming together at the right time.
Now, you mentioned the series of workshops that are going to happen with the one in Portage being the very first one. Mm-hmm. Give us a little more detail about what this event coming up on the 31st is mm-hmm. going to be, and if anybody is interested in attending this workshop on the morning of Halloween, how they can do that.
Certainly. These workshops, as you had mentioned before, there are six around the state. The first one is on Halloween morning here at NRPC, and NRPC is located in Portage at 6100 South Port Road. The easiest way I tell people, if you know where Bass Pro Shops is, then you'll know where we are. Mm-hmm. The event takes place from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. There is a working lunch involved. The cost is $25, but it's $20 if you're a member of the Indiana Parks and Recreation Association or the Greenways Foundation. For those who might not know if they are part of the Greenways Foundation, we do have a license plate program. And if you have a license plate, you're a member of the Greenways Foundation. Ah. And so you can come in for that discounted rate. But yeah, we're really looking forward to it. We're getting a lot of interest already, and we're looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Now, we know that the series of workshops begins, we said, on October 31st, runs through November 8th. Mm-hmm. Once the series of workshops is complete, what seems to be the next step that Greenways Foundation is going to take to move this all along in the hopes of creating the series of trail towns?
Certainly. And when we have the conclusion to the workshops, we'll be working with Amy, the consultant, and having a strong evaluation process about how this went down and what was the feedback, and probably do some surveys with those who attended and kind of get their feedback and find out where it goes next. We're looking to get moving on this rapidly while the iron is hot, and to hopefully take the recommendations and the interest to statewide agencies, primarily tourism, and to kind of gauge their interest to see how it works out from here. Now, if tourism might not be able to handle it at this point, I think the Greenways Foundation would probably start the movement, and to do so maybe as early as next spring.
So you have to lobby with the lawmakers to be able to get the funding to be able to help to get the program going, I suppose?
I don't even know if legislators are involved here. I mean, it makes such a strong case for tourism interest mm-hmm. that we believe we can work with them outside of any kind of legislative work. Legislation is a whole different animal when it comes to this, but I believe that tourism, as it has been done in Kentucky and other places, they should be able to embrace this going forward.
One other question I did want to ask that came to mind as we were talking here about the opportunities that are available for trails all across the state. Do we find some portions of the state have more trails, like Northwest Indiana, mm-hmm. and some have fewer? So does that make it more difficult to create the trail towns?
Well, yes and no. Again, the trail towns are interesting because what they're doing is we're kind of shaking the tree, and we're bringing a lot of advocates out of the woodwork here, and we're finding that out, especially in Southwest Indiana. If you take a look at the visionary map that was prepared by the Indiana Department of Natural Resources that shows all these connections throughout the state, there's kind of a big gap in Southwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. However, there's a lot of interest. I mean, I just had a workshop in Jasper, which is near the French Lick vicinity, and they're all happy about trails, but we don't see any visionary corridors there. So with this program, hopefully what will come about is a better understanding from state officials at the DNR that these communities want to see trails connect, and we're going to see them on proposed maps and, again, with the Trail Town program going forward.
It sounds like the Trail Towns program is liable to spur the development of even more trails. Like you say, especially in these areas of the state that they don't have very many trails, if any at all, really to speak of.
So. Well, certainly. And, you know, we have a lot of different communities that are on trails, you know, especially in the northern part of the state. The Panhandle Trail is one. It goes from Winnemac to the Logansport vicinity. It's a 20-mile route. It goes through several farm cities. I never heard of Star City before.
Uh-huh.
So there is a Star City in Indiana. It's a very localized sized community, maybe a few hundred people. But again, they're set up very well for this program, and they could take great advantage of it.
Well, it sounds like the Trail Towns concept is going to have a great opportunity in Indiana, mm-hmm. and it's wise to take advantage of it. But the way to do it is to learn more about it. And that's what all these workshops, starting with the one on Thursday, October 31st, is going to be all about in Portage at the NERPSI offices. And Mitch Marloga, he's in his capacity here, although he works for NERPSI.
Yes.
and deals in trails and things of the nature. But he, in this capacity, is the president of the board of directors of the Greenways Foundation of Indiana. And Mitch, thank you for coming by to talk about this.
And one last thing to interject, greenwaysfoundation.org is where they can register for the workshop.
That's good. Thank you for coming by and telling us about it. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. A Hammond woman is making a name for herself in the science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, field, and she's been named the up-and-coming woman of the year in STEM. Michelle Murday is the Northwest Indiana branch manager for a company called EnviroForensics. She was chosen by the Northwest Indiana Influential Women's Association for the honor, and she talked with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson recently about her career and about her plans to get more young women involved in STEM fields.
So I'm originally from Northwest Indiana, graduated from Munster, and then from Munster went to Ball State, and then lived in Indianapolis 5 years before I moved back up here last year.
Okay, well, congratulations. I understand that there's an inaugural award in STEM, and you have been named up-and-coming Woman of the Year in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math.
Yes.
Congratulations. How did you do that?
Thank you. So it all started was I was nominated. I'm not 100% sure by who. And then from there, you go through an application process. It's pretty lengthy, pretty extensive. Letters of recommendation, any awards, publications, your resume. You know, they ask you some questions about how you chose your field, challenges and obstacles you might have had along the way.
So how did you choose your field and how did you get into STEM?
Okay, so it's a pretty funny story. When I was in high school, probably just like everyone else, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I actually applied to Ball State with entrepreneurship because I thought I wanted to own my own restaurant after working at the Shoops in Munster throughout high school. And then when it got to, I think it was my senior year, second semester, I took an earth-based science class. And when we got to the rock and mineral sections, it just completely piqued my interest. It's nothing I had ever thought about. So from there, I started thinking, you know, is this something I could do? What's there to even do with rocks? You know, most people are like, how is rocks a career? So then from there, I actually purchased a book called Great Jobs for Geology Majors. And after reading the first couple of chapters in that, I had switched my career path at Ball State from entrepreneurship to geology.
Is your job, does it have to do with geology now?
It did when I first started. So when I first started at EnviroForensics, I was a field geologist, and that required me to go out and collect a lot of soil, water, and vapor samples. And in collecting those samples, you also have to describe any lithology you see, so the different types of soils that you can collect.
How did you kind of move up through the ranks in your job? Tell me a little bit about your career then.
Okay, so when I was a field geologist, I was more out in the field performing the oversight of all the investigation activities. And, you know, a lot of that's to determine the historical spills on the site. So we collect those samples and they go to a lab. And then from the lab, we can tell where the spill might have, general area of where the spill might have been released and to what extent and if we need to investigate any further or not. And then while I was also a field geologist, I performed the oversight of the remedial activities. So once we got full site investigation, then we could go through and figure out how are we going to clean up the issue. And then from there, I started writing some of the, like, our smaller reports, began analyzing the data. And about a year and a half into my career, I was promoted to a staff geologist. And that's where I started to write some of the larger investigation and remediation reports and then interpreting the analytical data. And then to help with that, it would be to develop our conceptual site models. And then as part of that, EnviroForensics gave me the opportunity to go to Golden, Colorado to learn a software called RockWorks. And that actually allows us to prepare three-dimensional visualizations of the contamination. So we can actually put everything into this software, and it'll give us, you know, the plume shape, size, you can put in lithology, the groundwater elevation. So it's kind of really cool to see, maybe a little hard to describe over the phone, of what exactly it looks like. And then from there, I was promoted to project manager. And then at that time, kind of more of what it sounds, I began managing each of the projects by implementing and advancing the investigation and remediation activities, just to make sure, you know, everything's done within the work scopes, preparing the work scopes, making sure everything's to quality control standards. And then we also have to manage all the administrative, budgetary, and technical aspects of all of our assigned projects.
For women, you know, who are in high school now and they want to get into STEM, what's your advice to them?
So STEM, trades, arts, or any other career, just follow your gut and do something that you're passionate about. If anyone says you can't do it or shouldn't do what you want to do, just use that to fuel your fire. Every time somebody told me I couldn't do it or I wasn't going to make it in my career path, I wanted to prove them wrong that much more and show them that I could do it and I was meant to do something that I wanted to do. And then some days will be hard and challenging, but those days you know that you're learning. And if you aren't sure of an answer or how to do something, never be afraid to ask questions and treat every day as a learning experience and never stop growing.
Did people actually tell you along the way that you wouldn't make it?
Multiple. It was probably the end of my junior year, I was the president for the Ball State Geological Society. And one of the people at the job fair, another lady, actually came up to me and told me that I was never going to make it because I was there in high heels. And everyone in the environmental field is always in some kind of steel-toed boots. And to this day, I find it funny because I wear high heels daily, but I do have my steel-toed boots in my car at all times.
Very good.
Right?
Very good. Congratulations to you on all that.
Thank you.
What are your future plans and how are you going to, I mean, being in the position that you are, how are you going to give back to the community?
I would really like to start mentoring maybe a couple of women in the area or even a group of women that maybe are interested in a career path in STEM, just, you know, to help them maybe get through some of the struggles that they might have along the way or insecurities or just, you know, questions. Because some of my classes, I know I was the only female in an all-male class, and sometimes that in itself could be intimidating. So just give them the encouragement that you can get through it.
You know, I don't want to be negative, but why is it so hard for women to get into STEM? I mean, is it, and it seems like more guys get into it. Is it just like the way our brains are wired?
That's a question that I wish I knew the answer to. I don't know if it's just a more of a gender role type thing of, you know, you grow up and all your friends are going into X, Y, or Z, and why do you have to fall in one of those categories? Why can't you go into a STEM field?
There have been more than 1,000 illnesses and multiple deaths linked to e-cigarettes, and the median age of people who have gotten sick is just 23, highlighting that these products are used by many young people. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett reports that some research is finding that the health problems go even further.
The dining hall on Butler University's campus in Indianapolis is bustling. Students, mostly freshmen and sophomores, talk with friends, do classwork, and eat lunch. I'm here to talk with students about a much-discussed topic in recent weeks, vaping. Sitting in a corner with some friends, sophomore Brian Williams says he has some concerns about e-cigarettes.
I wish kids in high school and anybody below that wouldn't get into it. I started because I used to smoke cigarettes, so I feel like it was a healthier alternative, but now you just see like these kids doing it just because it's cool.
A recent study at Butler estimates that 60% of students use vaping products, and most of them have never smoked traditional cigarettes.
I mean, for using it, I guess so, but not anyone who's like using it daily.
Yeah.
I feel like just at parties, that's where you get a lot of people saying that they've used it.
I also spoke with a woman who conducted the Butler study. We sat in her sun-soaked office in the pharmacy building on campus. Amy Peake chairs the Health Sciences Department, and she surveyed 1,000 students about vaping products, including those made by industry leader Juul.
Honestly, my interest sparked when my now high schooler was exposed to Juuling when she was in middle school.
The recent deaths and illnesses have turned the national spotlight towards the health impact of vaping. And while the long-term health effects are still unknown, Peek says there are problems even among casual users.
We have found that students not only, you know, have the cravings and the headaches and the types of things that you think about, one of the most common reported withdrawal symptoms in our survey was the inability to concentrate.
Heavier users report shortness of breath.
There is no 18 to 22-year-old who doesn't have lung disease that should be reporting actual shortness of breath.
She says 5% of students surveyed admitted to replacing the nicotine pods with something else. The most common replacement was THC, the active compound in marijuana. The Centers for Disease Control cautions against using vaping products that contain THC. However, the CDC says no one product or additive has been pinpointed as the cause of the illnesses. Here's Dr. Ann Shookit of the CDC on a phone call with journalists.
This may be more complicated even than we think in terms of more than one product being risky, more than one label on the product, and more than one substance within the product.
As the CDC research continues, some Midwestern states are taking action. Ohio increased its smoking age, and Michigan has banned flavored e-cigarette products. But will students stop vaping? Peek says while traditional cigarettes are considered socially unacceptable by most students, e-cigarettes don't carry the same stigma. In fact, Juul is in a league of its own.
If you ask a young person who uses a Juul, if you ask, do you smoke, they're going to say no. Many times, if you ask, do you vape, they're going to say no. If you ask specifically, do you use a Juul or similar device, then and only then are they going to say yes.
In Butler's crowded dining hall, I asked freshman Sophie LaPosha if she thinks all the recent illnesses will make her classmates think twice about vaping.
I feel like it'll make people like think about it, but I don't really feel like it makes people stop.
Butler student Brian Williams agrees. He doesn't think people will stop because early signs point to black market additives as the cause of the illnesses. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.